So the recent passing of my mother at the age of 90 has given me pause to reflect on my own mortality. It's made me think about how much longer I have to live as well. As it turns out, there are websites that claim to tell you the answer to that question: how long will you live? I tried five of them this week, took five different tests, came up with five different answers. According to the websites, I have anywhere from 13 to 40 more years to live. It's interesting that the longer the quizzes were, the longer they tended to say I would live, and the shorter they were, not only was it shorter that I would live, but the more disturbingly detailed they were on exactly when I would die. There was one that was only four questions. It wanted my birth date, my gender, whether or not I smoked, and I had to rate my lifestyle as being either normal, pessimistic, or sadistic. And when I answered those four questions, this clock popped up on the page counting down the seconds that I have left. There's another one, 30 questions about medical history, lifestyle. It asked things like whether I was right or left-handed and whether or not I had at least two daughters. And according to that website, I'm going to live to the ripe old age of 101. Now, of course, there's no website that can actually tell you just how long you have to live. And all of them come with disclaimers that say that very thing. And for most of these websites, Their point is really much more trying to encourage people to live in healthy ways. You know, and so they all talk about the things that we know. You know, eating right, avoiding tobacco and other drugs, all those sorts of things that we know make for a healthier lifestyle. Some of them, though, still offer some surprising suggestions. I mean, one of them noted that merely wearing your seatbelt increases your average life expectancy by 4 years. Having friends that are various ages instead of just all people the same age as you, according to another site, 3 years added to your life. And by the way, practicing your faith will help you live 2 years longer. Again, though, it's really about how one lives that they're focused on. One of the websites, medindia.net, put it this way. It says, while no tool can predict the future with absolute certainty, the purpose of our death clock is to help you not only have a fascinating glimpse into the potential length of your life, but also, more importantly, encourage you to make healthier lifestyle choices. In other words, the sites want us to think not only of when we die, but of how we're living right now, and encouraging us to have a life well lived. And really, that is what our story that Kenji just read for us is about as well. Jesus tells this parable in which the two main characters both die, but ultimately they find themselves in very different surroundings. One is carried away by angels and is resting at the side of Abraham, while the other one finds himself in a place of torment. Now, there are a lot of commentators you'll find that will examine this parable and try to figure out exactly what heaven and hell are like. Or there are people that will take this parable and make detailed arguments both for and against the idea of purgatory. But the truth is, this story really has pretty much nothing to do with trying to describe the afterlife. That's not Jesus' intent here. He's much more concerned, really, he's focused on the choices that we make while we are alive, much more than what happens to us when we die. And so he begins the story by introducing this unnamed rich man. Now, sometimes preachers or commentators will refer to this rich man by a name. They'll call him Dives. Well, Dives is simply the Latin word that is used here for rich man. It's not a name. It's just he doesn't have one. We're not told his name. Just two things. One, he wears fine clothes, and two, he eats really, really well. And then in contrast to this wealthy man, Jesus introduces his poor neighbor, Lazarus. This is interesting. Because in all the parables that Jesus tells, Lazarus is the only one who has a name. And in recent weeks, we've heard some of the most familiar parables, the prodigal son last week, the Good Samaritan a few weeks back. They don't have names. Only Lazarus, covered with sores as he sits outside this unnamed rich man's gate, hoping for a few scraps to salvage from the trash. He is the only one who has a name. It's very much unlike our own world, where we know the names of the very wealthy, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, but the poor are often nameless, indeed faceless to most of us. But the world of Jesus' parable is one in which the poor man has a name and the wealthy is anonymous. And so this Lazarus, who suffered greatly on earth, is depicted in the parable as being seated at the side of Abraham after his death. Now, the image that Jesus is probably drawing on here is the idea of a heavenly banquet. And Lazarus is given the place of great honor right next to the patriarch, the one who is the father of the Jewish people. And this Lazarus, who didn't have lifestyle choices when he was living, who was desperately hungry, dependent merely on the kindness of those more wealthy. And he is raised then to enjoy the consolation of paradise. And in contrast, the rich man, who presumably had all sorts of lifestyle choices and the power to shape the world around him, he is sent and suffering in agony. And this rich man then is unable to recognize that he no longer has the power that he had on earth. Because where he is, he's still trying to order people around, to do what he wants, demanding that Lazarus go and get him a cool drink to ease his torture. And even here, even in this place of anguish, the wealthy man can't bring himself to speak directly to the poor man who used to be sitting outside his gate. He does not acknowledge Lazarus directly, speaking instead to Abraham, and audaciously assuming the privilege that he had in his earthly life, asserting his continued position in the social hierarchy, this rich man asks Abraham to order Lazarus to serve him. Abraham makes it clear that's just not possible. The chasm that is between them is now too great for either to cross. And it's this point, then, that the rich man shows some sort of concern for others for the very first time in this story. He seems to show no real compassion while he was on earth, but now suddenly he's worried about his five surviving brothers. He wants to make sure they don't suffer the same fate. And so, still refusing to speak to Lazarus, he again addresses Abraham, asking him to send Lazarus back to these brothers. He wants them to have a chance to change their ways and escape the same fate that he is suffering. And if somebody comes back from the dead, well, maybe they'll listen to him. But Abraham tells them they have Moses and the prophets. They must listen to them. If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, then neither will they be persuaded if someone rises from the dead. This rich man has had his opportunity to live a life well lived. He had an entire lifetime to live in a way that honored Moses and the prophets, but he failed even to notice this poor man sitting outside his gate and suffering. We are continuing in our series of Lent on Christ Collides, and our theme today is Christ Collides with Our Selfishness, and it is perhaps the epitome of selfishness or self-centeredness to fail to even see the needs, the struggles of other people around us. That narcissism, that's what Jesus is critiquing in this parable. And it is a selfishness, a narcissism that we continue to struggle with today. For like the rich man in the parable, we too have Moses. We have the prophets. We even have someone who came back from the dead. And yet we still often do not see the blind, the lame, the mentally ill, the suffering, the imprisoned, the poor. They stay outside of our field of vision. And what's really shocking about this parable, or what should shock us, I think, is that this rich man appears to be living a pretty successful life that's not all that different than a lot of us here. Few of us have to worry about going hungry. Oh, sure, we may want to protest. We don't treat people as badly as this rich man did, but the truth is there's no indication in the story that the rich man personally mistreated or abused Lazarus in his lifetime. He merely lived his life in such a way that Lazarus and others outside his gate were rendered invisible. This happens to be the very text that modern-day prophet Martin Luther King preached on in the very last Sunday sermon he would ever deliver. And in this parable, in his sermon, he speaks about this rich man whom he calls Dives. And he says, Dives didn't go to hell because he was rich. Dives didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother, Lazarus. Dives went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Indeed, Dives went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. As members of a tradition that has long practiced conscientious objection to warfare, this is one battle from which we cannot claim exemption. Jesus invites us to set aside our selfishness, to engage directly with those in our world who are hurting. And when Jesus says that Lazarus lay outside the rich man's gate, he implies that there's a wall. And we too have our own walls, both literal and figurative, that we put up to keep people on the outside, those with whom we don't wish to associate. But Jesus demonstrates a different approach all throughout his ministry. He knew who the poor and the hungry were in his time. He spent time with them. He healed lepers. He restored sight to blind beggars. He fed thousands of hungry people who came to hear him speak out in the middle of nowhere. His ministry among the people that society routinely ignores, he knew them. He knew their stories. He knew their names. And so by naming this poor man Lazarus, leaving the rich man nameless, Jesus is offering a direct challenge to a society in which we know very well the names of famous and wealthy, but very rarely recognize the names of the poor. The fact is, of course, that for every Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, there are thousands of others. Darwin Boudreau and Doris Smith and Walter Wardlow, those are real people. Those are people with stories and needs, and like Lazarus, they present those of us who are middle-class North Americans with a real challenge also. Now, I don't want to suggest here that simply being poor makes one more noble than anybody who has more wealth. Those names I just listed, those are all people that I have encountered personally throughout my ministry in different churches that I've served who come seeking for help. And when I've given help to these individuals, they've lied to me. They have misused what I've given them, and then they have come back and asked for more help. And because of these sorts of experiences, it can be very tempting to give up. It can be tempting to just enjoy our lives, to ignore those needs that exist outside our gates, in our town, in our world. Because getting involved with people who are poor and who are hungry can get really messy. And so we put up practices and policies for giving assistance that are designed to keep people at arm's length. They're based on the idea that it is more important to make sure that people really deserve what we are giving them. And we're more worried about being wasteful than we are about being generous. More concerned with ensuring that those who receive benefits are qualified than with seeing that people get what they really need. And Jesus' example and his teachings collide very directly with those attitudes. And we saw it last week very vividly in the story of the prodigal. The father lavishly holds this feast for his wasteful and his utterly undeserving son. And the feast in that story stands in very stark contrast to the feast Jesus mentions in today's story, a feast that the wealthy man has for himself on a daily basis, while Lazarus longed for crumbs just outside his gate. The good news, though, the good news is that we are not doomed to suffer, either like Lazarus covered in sores or like the rich man who ends up in a place of agony. If we are looking to find ourselves in this story, the characters that most of us are probably most like are the man's brothers. We're still living. We still have choices. We have Moses. We have the prophets. We have Jesus himself who came back from the dead. And when that risen Christ collides with our selfishness, we are still able to choose which path we can take. Jesus teaches that a life well lived is not just about making choices that benefit only us. A life well lived includes shaping our lives in ways that care for the strangers at the gate, for the neglected on the margins, for the lonely in the shadows, for the hungry in the streets. The rich man went about his life apparently not paying attention to the one who was there right in front of them, and we need to take care that we do not do the same. Instead, Jesus calls us to view the hungry as our sisters, our brothers. He invites us to see them as people, not just as numbers, not as problems that need to be solved. And so if we continue to live like the rich man in a parable, if we live as though our lifestyle choices make no difference to what happens to the poor, if we selfishly ignore the Lazarus on our doorstep, well, then I fear we too may be lost. But if we walk in the way of Jesus, if we learn to actually know some of the poor as our neighbors outside our gate, if we choose a life well lived in generosity, in compassion, then we too may one day find ourselves feasting on the heavenly banquet at the side of Abraham, accompanied by Lazarus, and hosted by Jesus himself. Interestingly, those websites I mentioned earlier, several of them point out that living in such a way can actually extend our lives as well. One of the websites that's consulted gives you 3 years of credit if you volunteer regularly. And if I had answered sadistic instead of normal on that one site, it tells me I would have died in 2009. Of course, ultimately what we need is not a death calculator that tells us when we're going to die. We need a life calculator that helps us keep track of how we're living right now. As we seek to score a life well lived, we need to compute those opportunities that we have to reach out to the Lazaruses in our midst, adding up ways we respond positively, subtracting ways that we pass by. Because in the end, what matters is not when we die. What matters is a life well lived.